right, welcome back. It's Reef Threads Podcast 175. I'm Gary.
And I'm Christine.
And
175 is a lot.
You know it is. It really is a lot. I was going to look up in the, you know, like sesquicentennial or whatever that is, what 175 is. I don't know what that is.
I don't know. It's like the Queen's, you know, plasma jubilee. It's beyond diamond. Yeah.
Plasma.
I couldn't think of anything that was.
Yeah, it's, you know, plasma. That precious metal. That precious metal, plasma, yeah.
Well, it's, you know, I don't know. Don't ask me. I've had a long week.
I'm going with plasma. That goes on the anniversary, you know, that anniversary list, what the gift is.
Right, the first one is paper, the second one is clocks or something.
And yeah, you get to the 175th, you get plasma. and not the blood plasma either.
No, the kind that's at the center of the sun.
Right, that plasma. Yeah.
There we go.
There you have it. Okay, so that means got to be September, October. I can't count the weeks in my head right now, but we'll hit 200. We got to have special people for 200.
I think so. It's going to have to be really special people.
Yes. Yeah. So we'll be planning that. 200 of them. That'll be cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm speaking. Let's see. June 11, I'm in Dallas. Really looking forward to that. And then in November, I'm speaking at the Boston Society, and if things work out and they're receptive, we could have the two of us there.
Yes, that would be really fun.
Because, yeah, you mentioned that maybe you could make the trip to Boston.
Yeah, I think so, and it's a nice club to speak for, and, you know, they set it up really nice. So, yeah, that would be fun, because we've been kind of toying with that idea for a long time of doing sort of a podcast type talk. So it would be a little bit like a podcast, a little bit like a lecture, and a little bit just sort of a conversation thing. So that might be fun to do.
Yeah, that would be fun. So, yeah, I mean, I'm supposed to be going to talk about photography, but we can, I got to believe we can work something in to have the two of us involved, or you could be my lovely assistant.
Your lovely neophyte doesn't know how to take pictures assistant. So I can be the plant in the audience. So Gary, what is aperture?
Yeah, great. No, we're not doing that.
No,
not happening.
All right.
Mm-mm. No. So okay. So in November, potential for a Reef Threads Boston meeting.
Reef Threads on the road.
Yep. So we'll talk to them. We'll see. Let's see what else.
We had NIRAC this weekend.
NIRAC, that's right. You were at NIRAC. That's the, was it New England?
Right, New England Reef Association Conference. So it's the Long Island Reef Association's yearly get together,
which is held at
the Long Island Aquarium. And it's great because now they have the hotel, which is attached to the aquarium. And if you haven't been to that hotel, it's beautiful. So it's really, really nice. Jeremy was walking through, and he's like, Mom, this is like a 5-star fish hotel. Like a giant wink. Very, very nice. Really beautiful venue. The speakers this year were Julian Sprung and Charles Delbeck and Andy Rhine from Roger Williams University. And it was a really great event. The lectures were phenomenal. And we had a really funny thing kind of happen at dinner. So they have a banquet dinner in front of the reef tanks, which is great. So they open up the aquarium. They set it up for a banquet there so you can eat right in front of the tanks. So I happened to be lucky enough to be sitting at the table with Julian, Charles, and Andy and a couple of other reef people. And Charles was on his phone, and he's like, Julian, there's a Reef Central post. Somebody said you said something. And it was something to do with electrostatic attraction and skimming. So somebody was saying that this was right and somebody else was saying it was wrong. So somebody else just decided to, you know, had Charles's email and said, can you tell us whether or not you guys actually said this? And it ended up, he wrote back, well, I happen to be sitting at a table with Julian. So how does that ever happen? Because Julian's in Florida, Charles is in California. So it was just funny to kind of watch this whole thing play out in real time. You know, watching them go back and forth, and Julian's like, I don't think I said that. That doesn't make any sense. And, you know, watching them go through the books on their phones to try to find the exact sentence, you know, because they're just like us, you know, they can't let it just let it be. So, you know, then we spurred this whole discussion about what is electrostatic attraction, how it's different from static electricity, and how do skimmers really work, and the chemistry, and so it was like nerd heaven. So, and yeah, fish conference. So, yeah, what are the chances that you happen to catch both of them sitting at the same table at the same event that you can actually get an answer like that? So,
there you have it.
Pretty fun.
Recentral Live.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was good stuff. So, yeah, really nice event. Lots of fun.
Yeah, and once again, underscoring, if you have an event in your area of this kind, find time to get there, spend a little money to get there, because you're going to learn stuff, you're going to meet people, and you won't regret it just about every time.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me too, it's, you know, you go through your regular life, and usually there's not a lot of reef people in that, you know, at your workplace or your family, and then you go to one of these events, and you feel like, like people that understand me.
Yeah, exactly.
Not only understanding the lingo, and the language and the subject matter, but just, you know, it's people that think the way that you do. You know, we all kind of have the same aptitudes, and we sort of think a little bit alike, and we have the same need to know answers right away, you know, a lot of the same personality traits, I think. So all of a sudden you're in this environment where there's a whole bunch of people that are kind of like you. So it's like a family thing, you know, you feel it's pretty nice. So definitely it's good. You know, you can find people and you can sit and talk about reefs all day and nobody will say that, you know, will feign interest. They will actually be interested.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And you won't get the spouse thing. All right. Enough. Shut up. Moving on. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, plug for Joe Waiulo and the Long Island Aquarium, because, there was a thing you sent me a few days ago about the, somebody published what was the top 25 aquariums in the country, right, and, Long Island Aquarium not on that list, and, wrong, need to be on that list. And
I think it's public aquariums. I think that's why
that's why.
Happened. We've had that. I remember that happened a couple of years ago as well. It's public aquariums. Private aquariums are not considered for those lists.
Well, you got to get there. If you're in the New York area, and it's not really close to New York City, but you get there, and go to the Long Island Aquarium. And yeah, it is the perfect thing, because you can get there and you could easily spend a day and a half or more at the Long Island Aquarium with the penguins and everything. And that hotel, I mean, literally connected buildings. So yeah, you can go there and stay and go right over the aquarium. And it's in a nice little town. So there's nice walking around town with some old houses and nice little shops and stuff. And just a great little place to go for a 2 day or a long weekend or something. And, beautiful out there in Long Island, really a pretty area, and, really recommend that. It's just a great place. And to see what Joe has done with the reef and his anemone tank, and, the penguins are just a blast. And
they
the
are.
Kids, ton of things for the kids to do. And just really worth the trip just for that.
I forgot to tell you something. You're going to be very jealous in a minute. We went out. Actually, Todd Gardner took me and a couple of other people and a bunch of kids out to the river behind the aquarium. We were looking for shore shrimp, just regular grass shrimp, shore shrimp, because somebody was, I guess, taking home some cuttlefish and they needed food to feed them. So we went out with a big giant net, and it turns out that there were very few shore shrimp because it is mysid shrimp bloom. So you go out with a net, you know, maybe a foot square, opening net, and you pull up, easily as much as fit into a flat pack of mysid shrimp.
Wow.
Live. So I think Jeremy and I are going to take a trip out there this weekend and do a little harvesting, because we could in 10 minutes have enough mysis to feed the tanks for a year easily. Easily. Like, you could lean over, you know, over the walkway, and you could see them. They were so dense that you could see them swimming around just underneath the surface.
Mm. So what do you, you collect them and then bring them back and put them in Ziploc bags and just flatten them out and freeze them right away, the way they are?
Uh-huh. Yep, that's what I would do. I will, when I collect them, I'll probably put quite a few in the tank, and then I'll probably keep some in a bucket with an air stone for a while and see how long I can keep them alive so that I can sort of seed the tank with live ones for a little while. Because from what I was understanding from Todd, the shore shrimp are pretty constant population, but the mycids pretty much bloom in the spring and then go away. So the reason that the shore shrimp weren't available was that they were probably in deeper waters because the mycids are just taking up all of the oxygen at the higher levels of water, the surface water. So, so you just net them and throw them in a bucket. I'll probably bring one for live ones and one for, you know, harvested ones. And then I'll just flatten them out into Ziploc bags and freeze them, and that's great.
That's pretty slick. Now, this is a rhetorical question. Has Todd Gardner ever been in walking distance of a body of water that he didn't collect something out of it?
Well, it's funny you ask, because we were, the idea to go out and collect these shrimp came up, and Todd was like, oh, I'll just go to the car and get my net. And one of the kids said, you always have a net in your car? And Todd was like, I think I haven't not had a net in my car since I was driving. So
yeah, I believe that. I believe that.
I do too. Yep. Probably several nets. So
yep.
So that was pretty great.
Yeah, it was. It still amuses me. I mean, it's fantastic, because you can tell the guy absolutely loves aquatic life. But the last time I was there, we went to that big fancy restaurant on the hill and had dinner, and then we're out walking along the shore. Next thing I know, Todd's hanging over the dock. Net in hand, collecting whatever. It's just flashlight. He comes fully equipped. Yeah, it's great. Yep, fun to watch him, because he just gets. You can see the blood starts flowing faster. And,
yeah, well, I think that's why Todd's had so much success, because he just has that passion, and he's never he's always into it. You know, it's always exciting for him, even the mundane things like netting shrimp.
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah, Aquarius of the year, Aquarius every year.
Yes, pretty much. I think that's true. So hopefully we can get Todd on to the podcast and talk a little bit about his new gig and what he's been up to. I think that'd be really kind of fun.
Yeah, yeah, he does it well, so that's great.
He does.
And speaking of people who are just committed to this hobby and aquatic life, Richard Ross has me thinking, and this is a good follow-up. That guy, Richard... Yeah, thanks. But this is a follow-up to last week, because he has this piece on Advanced Aquarists where he raises the question about whether designer clownfish can serve a function as feeder fish.
Right.
All right. Now, we've been talking about breeding fish and getting this hobby to the point where captive bred fish are commonplace, affordable, all those wonderful things and all the benefits. And you have those
golden nuggets.
Are they still cute?
They're adorable.
Okay. That kind of clownfish, designer clownfish, and Richard Ross, now we're talking about raising them and keeping them and growing them and enjoying them and all the benefits. Now he's talking about using them as feeder fish. And when I saw that headline, I go, what, did he bump his head? What's wrong with him? But it's legitimate thinking.
It is. And I think that, he does this, with the idea in mind that it's going to spur some discussion. But,
oh, you think?
Yeah. But, but that's what Rich is good for. I think, if you step back, away from your initial emotional response to that, I think it makes perfect sense, because who are we to say that because a fish has been bred to be expensive, that it is more valuable than the life of a feeder guppy? To my thinking, it's no different. And if we have a fish breeder that's breeding these clowns, if you normally the breeder is going to go through, if they're a good breeder, and is going to have to cull some because they're, you know, misformed or they don't have the right coloration or whatever it is that you're looking for, that you're breeding towards, why not use those fish as feeders as opposed to just destroying them? In a sense, if you have that as an option where you don't feel like you're doing something as cruel, then perhaps if you're trying to breed for an unusual trait or a recessive trait that doesn't come up as much, then maybe you'll get there faster because you'll cull more. So to me, One Life, Guppy, Ugly Goldfish, Fancy Designer Clownfish, you know, $1,000 Dr. Seuss fish, a life is a life. So to me, it makes no difference at all.
Yeah, after the initial shock and uncomfortable feeling I had, I came around to that too. And part of the follow-up to our discussion last week was Kathy Leahy, who has been breeding clowns and selling them in the St. Louis area for a long time, is well known for the quality of her fish, commented that she has a whole truckload of clownfish that she basically can't give away
mm-hmm.
because of the market dynamics. And then one of the things that was mentioned in Richard's piece, either him or a response, I think it was Richard, that this is another outlet for people who are raising clownfish. You have a bunch of extras you can't move, sell them as feeders, and at least get something out of them.
And, right.
You know, there's some thinking there, too.
If nothing else, you know, one of the things that we had talked a little bit about was holding costs. When you have fish that you can't sell, you still have to feed them. They're still taking up tank space that you could be using for, you know, subsequent generations. So sometimes, just like, you know, a store has to clear inventory to make way for the new season, maybe this is a way to clear out inventory to make way for the newly hatched eggs and, you know, next generations of bred fish. You know, if you don't have anything else to do, you know, otherwise you end up with like the crazy cat lady of fish with, you know, 79,000 fish that you can't get rid of.
Right.
So maybe this is a way.
Well, I think it's original thinking, and to even have this thinking in process or in place at a juncture when we're still thinking we're going to get over the hump with captive bred fish to keep in our aquariums. I mean, that's the step way after that, and already we're seeing that come into play, and it really gave me a picture of a real interesting dynamic in what's happening with fish, marine fish in this hobby, is that we have people who are trying to figure out how to breed fish, and at the other end, simultaneously, we have discussion about, we have so many marine fish captive bred that we can use them as feeders for other fish.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, and of course, it isn't fully formed fish, but now you start to think all the larval stages, all the stages of clownfish.
Exactly. I was just thinking that.
Yep. Could be probably in many cases as good or better food than fully formed settled fish. So.
Right, and it's providing you with a large variety of food item sizes that way, too. You know, if it's easy enough to breed clownfish, which it is, then in theory you would have multiple different clutches of eggs hatching at different times, so you would have multiple different food sizes.
Right. And, you know, I mentioned Kathy Leahy, this is something normally I would do in private, but she sent me email. Hi, Kathy. She listens.
Hello.
She sent me email that went into my junk. I never responded. I don't clean out my junk file very often. And I ran across it. Kathy is having success breeding pipefish. So she's sitting there with a bunch of clownfish she can't get rid of, and she's having success breeding pipefish. And it'd be my guess that if she can't move the clownfish, she wants them out somehow or another because she wants room for pipefish.
Yeah.
And Kathy, the response to your question, am I coming to St. Louis soon and will I photograph, working on a trip, it's not going to be real soon, will I photograph pipefish in your tanks? You're darn right I will. I'll be in touch. Mm-hmm. I'll kill to do it. So,
I wouldn't mind having a friend who is a fancy clownfish breeder that would provide me with feeders, because that would make it possible for me to get my little teeny tiny little anglerfish.
There you have it.
Right? Because that's my one reservation, is just I can feed it during the summertime and the spring, But once it gets into the cold of winter, I can't go out and harvest live food. So what would be, that would be awesome.
And what fish easier to keep alive in an aquarium as a feeder?
Yeah.
Yep. Clownfish just as well as goldfish in freshwater.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
Yep. So this is just interesting thinking, and it really takes us, it adds the complete other end of the spectrum to this captive bred question and the role it's playing in the economics and the dynamics that we're experiencing in this hobby. I mean, this, it makes you wonder. We've got, they just announced the Marine Breeders Institute, the MBI workshop coming up in July. Now, I opened up a can of worms here because I don't remember the date. But Tal Sweet organizes that in Michigan, and I'm wondering if this won't be a subject of discussion at that event this year, this whole issue of captive bred and the role it's playing and the economics at that event, and a tremendous event. We'll talk about it more at another time and give the full dates, but I know this year I couldn't last year because of a conflict, but I sure hope to go this year because it's a tremendous event where you get breeders of all kinds together for a weekend and just terrific discussions. And even if you're not breeding, as I've said many times, you'll learn something at that event. Really terrific. So, there's a lot to talk about. And I'm sure that event will be full of a lot of this discussion because there's just in the past year, we've just seen a tremendous change in what's going on with fish. So, just great. Let's see. We need to have a question of the week.
Question of the week.
Will she remember, folks?
Okay. Do you store frozen food? Oh. I know. You wanted me to forget.
I did.
Do you store frozen food in your family's refrigerator and freezer, or do you have a separate freezer? I will answer. I keep it right next to the ice cream. That is true. Sad, but true. It makes late night snack getting a little more exciting because, you know, you never know what you're going to get. No, I don't have a separate freezer, so I keep everything, in one freezer. Usually I keep them actually in the door of the freezer, which probably isn't the best, but I go through it quickly enough. And that way it's sort of in its own little contained area. But no, I don't keep it separate.
Me neither. I have, two shelves, I guess they are, in the door that are allotted for frozen fish food. And then in our freezer, we have two tubs at the bottom of the main part of the freezer. And I have one where I keep ice packs and extra frozen food. So I have the tub and two shelves in the freezer. But it's right in with the rest of the food. All kept in plastic bags, of course, and all that. But right in there. And then I keep my ice packs in there in the event that I might need them for any fish thing or if you get a muscle strain or something. We always have frozen ice, but they're always there just in case. And, yep, right in there with the rest of them. No separate freezer for me.
No.
Yeah.
You keep seafood in your freezer. Why wouldn't you keep these foods?
Right. Exactly. I think it took Margo a little bit to get over it, but yeah, pretty much that's just it.
Actually, you know what? That ties back to Boston in a funny way. So,
okay.
In the, complete turnaround. One of the things that the Boston Club does is called fish goo. So what they do is they get everybody that wants in, they get a blender, a couple blenders or food processors, and anybody that wants in on the fish goo brings in something. So brings in nori or clams or oysters or squid, whatever, mice, a shrimp, anything, whatever is good. And they bring it in frozen and they throw it all together in one big, you know, pile and run it through the food processor to get, you know, finely shredded material and then bag it up and whoever brought in stuff gets a bag to take home, which I think is kind of cool. It's a good idea. But it is tradition, Gary, that they request of the speaker that they partake of the fish goo. So here's your fair warning.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. That has to be a special smell,
it's,
too.
It's rumor has it that only two speakers have actually followed, you know, have done it. You could be a third.
I'll be shocked if I'm a third.
I would suggest bringing chips.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
That's all I'll say.
Yeah, with chips and a special salsa. Uh-huh.
There you go.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, yeah, we'll see.
Right.
Don't count on it.
Letting you know. But anyway, fish goo, really cool idea.
Yeah, it is. You know, when you look around, a lot of clubs do a lot of neat stuff. If you just look around and keep your eyes open, there's just some neat stuff that clubs do. And that's a good one. Mm-hmm. Everybody benefits. Everybody contributes. Everybody benefits. And you know there are a million stories that come out of those events.
Right. Well, yeah. I think the best one was that at a previous meeting, somebody had brought something in that wasn't quite good anymore.
Uh-oh.
And I don't think the speaker ate it that time, but somebody else did, a young man who proceeded to then return the fish goo.
Yes, immediately.
Pretty much immediately, yeah.
Okay, got to give him credit. Mm-hmm. Got to give him credit. Hey, let's bang on the tanked people a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah, let's bang on them. Not that they deserve it, but let's do it anyway.
So, right. So the tanked people, in addition to their wonderful television show, have done a lot of product launches, right? So they have their own salt. They have their own additives. One of the things that they have is an instant cycle. And the idea of this is that it's a bacterial product that's supposed to cycle your tank instantly. Now, we can take that as a standalone, which is, you know, a little bit hard to believe. But then having the tanked people say that something allows a tank to cycle immediately, I wouldn't use anything that the tanked people use, because their reputation in the hobby, if you talk to people that have to take in the fish that they, you know, set up in these displays and then, you know, become very, very ill. If they don't die, then they end up with, you know, usually with friends of ours, unfortunately, allegedly. But I have heard from more than one instance of installations that they've done where it is exactly the way they do it on television, where they fill up the tank one day, they put the fish in the next day, and they leave. And then everybody that's left with the tank is left sort of picking up the pieces there. So, and the reason that they say that they can do that is because they add this magical cycle. And that's supposed to make everything okay. So what happened in this case is, I guess there's a tanked UK, their distributor there, and somebody actually made a video to show you that this stuff works, right? And so the way
did we mention this is a story on Aquanerd?
Yes. So Brandon brought this to our attention. So this is great. Yes. And you can go to Aquanerd, and he actually has the video there. But the gist of it is this. So what they did was they set up a monitor on the tank to measure ammonia and nitrate. And then they dose this stuff in, and then they put the fish in. And what they're saying is that, you know, after they dose the stuff, the tank is cycled. So they put the fish in, and they monitor ammonia and nitrate for 5 days. Well, okay, first of all, 5 days is like nothing, right? But anyway, what they do is they show that at the beginning there's no.
And this is a raw tank,
yeah.
Raw rock, not live rock, raw sand, fresh salt water.
Right, and
nothing,
fish.
No biological, nothing in it.
Right. So they put in this magic sauce, and then they put the fish in, and they say everything's perfect because they look at the numbers. And they show that at the beginning there was like a very, very small spike of ammonia. And then at the end of the 5 days, they're showing nitrate. And that's supposed to be evidence that the tank is cycled because there's nitrate. But what Brandon points out is if you look at the video, on the fifth day, there's also ammonia. And the ammonia is actually climbing from day one. And what they also don't tell you is that they don't really feed the fish in those first couple of days, or they feed them very, very sparsely. So there's not a lot of food going on in there. So to my thinking, you start out with a tiny bit of ammonia, you have a little bit more. Yes, you have nitrate, but if you still have ammonia, you're still cycling. So I think that that tank is just beginning the cycle. And if they had extended their testing and measuring out from that 5 days to a week, 2 weeks, a month, we would see the usual succession of ions going on when you see a cycle. You would see the ammonia, you would see the nitrite, then you would see the nitrate, you'd see the ammonia drop down. I don't think that that evidence, you know, I agree with Brandon, that evidence doesn't show that the tank is cycled. That evidence shows that the tank is about to cycle.
Right. If there's any ammonia showing up and you just add a bunch of fish, and they never add just one or two fish.
No,
it's
no.
always a small truckload of fish. If after 5 days you're still showing ammonia and it hasn't been converted, there's no way it's cycled, not even a snowball's chance. And when that number of fish and you start feeding them like they need to be fed, your ammonia is going to go absolutely through the roof because
right.
there's no bacterial colony just to convert that. It's,
right.
it's not there. And, oh,
yeah.
man. You know, and so, yeah, so then why do we hear time and time again about these tank projects and 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month or whatever later, it's just dead fish all over the place? Well, yeah, because ammonia kills fish.
Yeah, it's funny how that works.
Just in general, it does.
Right.
And if it doesn't, the ick will get them too.
You know, the other thing that I'm thinking about too is that, you know, when we talk about a tank being cycled with a capital C, I think what we really are referring to is that, yes, there is bacteria in the tank and this bacteria that's used to process nutrients, but a truly cycled tank means that the bacterial load there is sufficient, is just enough and not too many, to process the amount of nutrients that tank produces on a regular basis. So every
At that time. Yes.
Every time you change that, either by adding livestock or taking away livestock, you're going to have a mini cycle because the bacterial level has to adjust either up or down to fit the needs of the tank, right? Because if there's more nutrients, then there's more room for the bacteria to grow. There's more bacteria. If there's less nutrients, then the population will die off some because there aren't enough nutrients to sustain it. So the idea that this bottle would have the exact right number of bacteria to actually sustain this is a little far-fetched, I think. And I don't think that the amount in the bottle is 5 days is not enough for it to completely go through a whole sort of settling in because they, again, you need to, the ecosystem has to balance out and there's just not enough time to do that. And then it almost gives the impression that once the tank is cycled, that never happens again. And we know that that's not the case. If the tank changes in any way, or if you have a fish die or an anemone die or something and you don't get to it and you have a, you know, huge uptick in nutrients, then even there, you're going to have a little tiny cycle. You're going to have a bump in nutrients until the bacterial filter is allowed to replicate enough to process it. So just this, I don't like the idea. I don't like the product and I don't like the idea that it is selling, which is the idea that the cycle is something that happens when you set up your tank and then never ever again.
Right. Well, and it's the old snake oil routine where we as humans are always looking for the instant, no effort solution to anything. And if you put it on the label and do a little hocus pocus and, you know, put out a video and it's on the internet, so it must be true. And people aren't looking at it critically. They're focused on, I want the quick, easy solution. You'll sucker a lot of people into it.
Yeah.
And they're on TV. I mean, whatever they do on TV, it's on TV. Has to be right.
Right.
And sorry, it's not. It's just not.
No. And people aren't going to, if you don't read the books and if you don't do the research, you're not going to know that it's not right.
Right. Okay. Dumb guy question. There have been through the years a million of these bacterial dosing products.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's you can go to any fish store with any dry goods shelving space at all. You can get at least one, if not two, bottles of bacteria that will, according to the label, you know, pretty much cut your cycle in half. Do all kinds of wonderful things for your biological load, bioload capacity, blah, 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 blah. I have never bought into that from day one because I have never been convinced that you can put live bacteria in a bottle, in a manufacturing plant, seal it up, ship it, have it sit on docks, sit in warehouses, sit in store shelves for whatever length of time, open that thing up, dump it in your tank, and be assured that you're putting any quantity of live bacteria, live affected bacteria of whatever species or, you know, whatever it is. I've never been convinced that you can do that with any assurance whatsoever. Is that, am I right?
Yes and no.
I knew you'd say that. It depends.
It depends.
You always say that.
So there's a long history of using bottled bacteria in wastewater management. And there it's effective, right? So you can get bottles of bacteria. They add it to wastewater treatment facilities to help break down waste, right? It does basically the same thing. And I think some of our companies even use the same source material. So is it possible? Yes. And I think it can be effective in those situations. That said, I have not seen, except for maybe one exception, I have not seen any of these other products provide any sort of evidence or studies that show that their bacteria is living or does anything, right? So can it live in liquid like that? Sure. There are plenty of bacteria that can live in stasis. I don't know if the species that we usually declare as our bacterial filter are those species, but there are some that do, okay? Now, that said, so I've gotten some of these products from wastewater treatment facilities, and if you smell them, they're sulfurous. They're pretty stinky. And that's fine. That's what they're supposed to be like, and that's normal. If you actually, what's interesting is if you grow biopellets in stagnant water, you'll get the same smell. So I think that there's probably the similar species growing on our pellets, and that makes sense, right? Because that's what we put the pellets there for. If you go to these products and you open the bottle, like the only product I can think of offhand is called Cycle, right? And it's basically just water. It doesn't smell like anything. So does that mean that there's nothing in there? Not necessarily. There could be, but again, until I see actual evidence of that, I don't believe it. But that's true of most things. I don't believe it until somebody can show me data or even anecdote that shows that, you know, they did an experiment and it did something.
But see, you also hit on something that has always made me skeptical. Is, yes, I'm aware that freshwater, that they use bacterial colonies like in that manner in freshwater.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about marine.
Correct.
And so if we're using, and there have been many instances where freshwater bacteria have been used as a marine solution, I don't see how that works either.
Yeah, I don't know for sure. And I know that there are companies that have done that exact thing, that have done the research in freshwater systems and then just sort of translated it over to marine systems. I think that my guess is that we don't really know a lot about it. Even over the past, you know, since I've been in the hobby, the whole paradigm has changed a lot, because when I first started doing research into this, we had the Nitrospira, and a couple of other species that these were the ones that were our, you know, bacterial filter. But since then, at least, or maybe just I was doing better research, I think that there's other, even just giant families of bacteria, the Anammox, the ammonia, anaerobic ammonia oxidation species. It's a whole other different branch that actually does multiple steps of the biological filtration. So I think that there is a lot more going on than we think. My guess, too, is that, you know, we're putting these things that are in liquid culture and we're imagining that a lot of this is happening in the water column. I think it's not. I think it's happening in the surfaces of rock in these anaerobic environments. So that would be my guess, is that a lot of the processing is going on in anaerobic environments. These bottles are aerobic. So unless they have some sort of technological way of keeping those bottles oxygen-free, you know, maybe they're just a different species, or maybe they're not those. I think there's just a lot unknown there.
Well, yeah, I would have no doubt there's a lot unknown. And I just have always struggled with that because it just didn't make sense to me on an ongoing basis. And then to buy a bottle or package or whatever of, quote, live bacteria and then use some of it and then have the rest sit in now an unsealed bottle. I don't care how tight you put the lid on, an unsealed bottle. And then to come back, say, 3 or 4 weeks later and expect that to be as effective, I have my doubts about that. I just, and time and time again, if it worked, we would be using it regularly. But the end result is the only effective way to cycle a tank is to wait the 4, 6, 7, 8 weeks of time the way we're taught to do it. And cycle it all the way through till there's no ammonia, no nitrite, and you have nitrate at some level, and then slowly add your animals. I mean, that's just a time-proven method, and to me, there's just been no product put on a shelf yet that will shorten up that time and give you an effective cycle. And
right. I think there may be live bacteria in them, and there probably is bacteria in quite a few of them, but whether those bacteria are the right bacteria or whether they're active is another story. And the other thing is, again, going back to bioload, if you put them in, you know, at the very beginning of the tank to seed it, but you don't have any animals producing any ammonia or nutrients to process, they're going to, you know, grow to that certain level and stop. But the level of bacteria that, you know, is required for a tank with no fish and the level that's required with a tank with a full load of fish is quite significantly different. So this idea that your tank is cycled and you can add whatever you want is still crazy because, again, you need to do it incrementally so that the bacterial population can adjust to meet the nutrient load. So even if it did cycle, it's only going to cycle to that moment. And so as soon as you change the system, you're going to have to recycle it.
Yes, and that also gets to the generally, I think it's generally accepted belief or experience that your tank really doesn't settle in until it's been running for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that all those little dynamics that you can't see in your tank all have to get settled and adjusted and resettled, and you're adding animals and you lose an animal and you know one dies behind a rock and you don't see it, and so you have decaying going on. All those things that happen in that first year, particularly if you're a rookie, that you're learning and you're requiring that ecosystem to adjust and readjust up and down and up and down, and it takes a year plus before things stabilize so that your little ecosystem settles down and you start to have corals growing and the whole thing begins to work the way it should. And it's, you know, that's the critical year of husbandry and all kinds of things. And this whole instant, we've talked about it before. You walk down that aisle of bottles in any store and you start picking up stuff, you better think twice because a lot of that stuff is just not going to do you any good.
Mm-hmm. It's the old rule that good things don't happen quickly.
Yep. Every time.
Yep.
All right. That's enough. Reef Threads Podcast 175, the Plasma Centennial Podcast. And not the blood plasma.
No.
No. We're finished.
Take care.
We'll be back next week. Goodbye.